hey. Thanks so much for joining me on the Cockti Podcast. I'm your host, Gary. In case you're new to the show, I'm the editor and recycling engineer here at Fortner.com. Now, that may sound like a small job, but if you saw how many packages we get here at the Fort every day, you'd realize a third of my waking hours are spent folding empty Amazon boxes. You may have seen me as the DM for Quest for the Cure or Icehole's Rime of the Frost Maiden, as Cicero on Cyberpunk Independence, as Doc on Scribes and Scrolls, or sailing on the SS Failboat over on Talon and Claw. If you like what you hear, please subscribe to the show or follow us on social media at fortnerd.com. That's at fortnerd, D-O-T-C-O-M. But also, if you follow me and you go to my pinned tweet and follow the very simple instructions, you could win a set of Blacklight CSI dice from our amazing friends at Legendary Pants. That's just awesome. But I don't make the rules, so you should definitely follow me if you don't already. Now, there's a bunch I'd love to talk about, so let's get into it. Quest for the Cure was this past weekend and altogether raised just over $2,000. It was an incredibly fun night, thanks to everybody who joined us in chat, donated, and pitched ideas at our heroes as they continued to unravel the mysteries of the vast and the forgotten realms. Of course, thanks as always goes to our incredible cast, Ed, Amy, Blair, Eric, and Emma, and our guest, Todd, without whom none of this success would be possible. Stay tuned for our next episode on June 26th. Into the Motherlands continues to crush its funding goals. They keep adding new stretch goals because the project has been so fantastically successful. I myself have suggested some fictional stories from the original explorers who discover Musalia. Of course, I have no idea what they're planning in the book, but damn it, give me this fiction from these incredible writers. I'm here for it and I need to know everything. Monty Cook today announced that Tolis, the almost 700-page campaign setting, is now available for purchase. Tolis is built as a city of mysteries, secrets, and dark histories. Now, that's their rhyme, not mine. Admittedly, that last rhyme was me, though. So, full disclosure on that. It's a hefty tome that's available in the Cypher system and 5e. You can snag a copy at montycookgames.com. In other publishing news, Mongoose has dropped a killer deal on its Traveler 2nd Edition game. If you're not familiar with Traveler, it's a sci-fi game famous for its in-depth character building system. In fact, it's so in-depth, it's the only system I'm aware of where your character can actually die before the game starts. It's pretty awesome, all things considered. The player's collection, including the 2nd edition starter set, the Traveler Companion Rules Expansion, and the Central Supply Catalog, is only $17.95 US. Now that retails for more than $100, so that's a killer deal. And if you pay $30, you'll get the Referee Collection as well, which includes an additional 10 titles to support your Traveler game. 10% of your purchase will benefit Direct Relief, a charity that sends protective gear and critical care medications to healthcare workers around the world and facilities in the US and Canada. It's a lot of fun for a great cause, so if you're interested, please check out the bundle of holding. You only have until June 21st. I'll drop a link in the show notes. I'm really excited for my guest today. B. Dave Walters is the man who's everywhere. He's known for his roles on LA by Night, Silver and Steel, Heroes of the Plains, as DM of the Black Dice Society, creator of A Darkened Wish, and the lead designer on Into the Motherlands, which is currently crushing its Kickstarter campaign. We talked about tabletop, D&D, Into the Motherlands, and more. I hope you enjoy my chat with B. Dave Walters. Dave, thanks so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure's all mine. Thank you for having me.
So I always like to ask this question because I like to know people's origin stories, but how they got started with tabletop, especially when they're so heavily invested in it now as you are. So what was your first experience with Dungeons & Dragons?
When I was 13 years old, I played an elven fighter mage thief that was based on Vampire Hunter D.
Do you have any memories of your first game with that character? Because that is very specific.
I mean, that's the truth. That's what happened. It was very much birth of a power gamer. I wanted to, just be able to do everything. Mm-hmm. And I mean, honestly, that I'm a party of one ethos still very much informs a lot of the things I do, you know, and a lot of my character design decisions. But yeah, he had a an entire town that he sort of like ran and protected, that he kind of was sort of the mayor of this town and protected it against all threats.
Nice. And that's sort of what got you hooked, is that once you figured out what you could do, you're like all in.
Yeah. D&D actually wasn't the very first game I ever played. Oh. It was Rifts. It was the first RPG, which, if you know that game at all, they had a real power creep problem that literally every supplement invalidated the previous supplement, like 100% of the time. And so it got out of hand very fast. And I let a buddy of mine know that I was playing that and enjoyed it. And he's like, oh, well, if you like that, you should play D&D. And it's like, what? Really? And then the rest is history.
Nice. You're a multidisciplinary artist. You're not just a tabletop performer. You're an actor. You're a writer. When did you know that a career in the arts was something you wanted to pursue? And what was the first sort of artistic path you took?
I always wanted it. I created my first set of comic book heroes when I was 5.
Oh, wow.
And then I really decided writing is what I wanted to do in high school when I was introduced to Shakespeare in the 12th grade. And so when I got my English degree, and I knew it's what I wanted, but also I was very practical. I didn't want to do the starving artist thing. Mm-hmm. Just from my own background, I'd kind of witnessed how much people you can care about can suffer when you're chasing that golden carrot type thing. So, you know, I was working the whole time, and, you know, marketing is my actual discipline. That's what I'm actually good at. This other stuff I do for fun.
Right.
And, so I was kind of living in both worlds all along. And, Jason Charles Miller got hooked up at Geek and Sundry over from his work with Felicia Day. Mm-hmm. And I had introduced Damien Poitier to Jason. They knew each other because of me. And then Jason had Damien on doing stuff over at Geek and Sundry. And I remember on the inside really being like, man, you guys wouldn't even be there if not for me. Like, but they were shooting for Eververse and stuff when I still had to work. And, then the opportunity to do Ask Your Black Geek Friend came along, and we shot it in the evenings. Mm-hmm. So I was able to do that. And then I was working and still streaming at night. And then I'd switched jobs right before my birthday, right before we shot We're Alive season 1. I switched jobs so much. So I went to the interview looking like I was in the apocalypse, because my beard was all fuzzy and my hair was all long. And I was like, sorry, I'm filming a role this weekend. I promise if I get the job, I will look responsible when I show up. And a couple months later, they ended up laying off the entire marketing department. They hired up a bunch of people and let everybody go all at once. And I was still trying to find another day job and not really getting any traction, mm-hmm. as the streaming and creative work just kept picking up and up and up and up and up. And then I just kind of looked around one day, and it's like, I mean, I'm kind of making equal to or greater than money. I think I can make this work. And there it was. The universe very much had to edge me off that ledge, because it probably would have been a long time before I just consciously chose to quit to pursue this.
Right. Because you're arguably one of the busiest tabletop guys around. You're streaming multiple shows a week. You're writing multiple projects right now. You're the lead developer on Into the Motherlands. You're the point person on the Kickstarter. And if that weren't enough, you're often an active participant in charity games, raising money for an incredible amount of causes. So what drives you? Where do you get the motivation to hustle so hard? And when do you sleep?
I'll let you know when I figure it out for the sleep. you know, it's, I'm a self-propelling machine. Like I never lack in motivation, mm-hmm. For a lot of reasons. The stuff I do is fun. It's hard fun, but it's fun. Mm-hmm. You know, like we were talking about just today, I had 2 meetings, recorded 2 podcasts, and had 5 interviews.
Yeah.
But it's all stuff I enjoy. I'm to the point now that I have had to turn down some projects, and it's weird because some of the stuff I've had to turn down is stuff that I once would have dreamed about doing.
Right.
That now I'm just like, can't do it. You know, that doesn't fit in. I think I take storytelling very seriously. Life is hard. Life has always been hard. Life is catastrophically difficult for a lot of people right now. And if something I do can help a person take their mind off their troubles for a little while, to make them feel like they're not alone or they're not crazy or they have a place that they fit in and belong as a part of a group that is taking this journey together, mm-hmm. then I feel like my time is being well spent, you know, because at the end of the day, that's what it is to me, is I'm trying to contribute something to reduce human suffering,
right?
Which sounds more grandiose than I mean it to when I say it out loud, but that's the truth of it. You know, that if I can make you laugh or make you smile or terrify you or make you cry, anything, you know, that just for a moment, that you're not worried about anything else, then that is something that I want to be able to give to the world. And, you know, I have made it where I've made it by saying yes to opportunities when they presented themselves and just giving it my absolute all. And if something's got to give on occasion, you know, that might be free time or sleep or, you know, things of that nature, that in the short term, you got to do it. Yeah. You know, at the height of my Patreon, I was running about 35, 40 games a month, wow, for 18 months, in addition to the streaming that you knew me for. So, I mean, I've run about 500 sessions of Vampire V5, because, you know, that was what it took at the time. And then when I backed off of that, it was a calculated risk, because, you know, that was a significant source of income. Mm-hmm. And I also moved at the same time, so my overhead went up and my income came down.
Right.
But I knew those were things I had to do. I had to have this studio. I had to have the time to be able to pursue other things. And, you know, by the will of the fates, it seems to be working out.
You said on social media that it sort of wasn't until the age of 39 that you sort of realized that you made it. What led up to that realization, and sort of how did that change your perspective? Is that related to your day job and that
switchover? No. And that's not quite what I said.
Sorry.
Hang on. Sorry. I'm choking to death. What I said was everything you know me for has happened after I was 39.
Okay.
That's true. Yes. All the stream stories. Oh, don't worry about it, man. I tweet so much garbage. I'm surprised you saw that. Everything you know me for has happened after I was 39. Because I think a lot of times people start to think that it's like, if I haven't done X, Y, and Z by this age, it's not going to happen. And mm-hmm. that's just not true. I mean, if you want to be like an Olympic powerlifter and you're like 50, that might be tough, but, you know, you never know. You might have the genetics for it, but otherwise, yeah, you know, there's time. You know, if you're alive, there's time. For me, when I felt like I'd made it, because this wasn't an AMA I think when I got cast for LA by Night, because everything I'd done before then was one shots and stuff. On We're Alive Frontier, I'd began as an alternate and got moved up to the main cast. But, you know, in the back of my mind, I always knew I wasn't anybody's first choice. That was the first time that it was a big flagship show that I was someone's first choice. Right. And I knew I'd already done the one shot with Jason, so he'd seen me in particular and what I was capable of and wanted me. That I knew I objectively had earned that.
Right.
You know, that was probably the first time.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're likely best known for Vampire and Dungeons and Dragons, equally specific for tabletop, I would say.
Yeah, probably.
If you could only choose one of those going forward, which would it be and why?
I mean, it's tough. If I was absolutely forced to choose, mm-hmm. probably D&D, because mm-hmm. It arrived in my life earlier and has always been there.
Right.
There was never a time that I was like, well, I was about to say there was never a time that I was like, oh, I'm over this. That's not true. I absolutely abandoned 4th edition and detoured over to Pathfinder, you know, to dwell in the wilderness for a time, you know, before returning for 5th edition.
Right.
Yeah. Probably D&D, you know, just to be able to dream bigger in all the worlds and planes and all of those things. Mm-hmm. I mean, I very much love the world of darkness, though. But, you know, it's although you have all the different settings, at the end of the day, it is this world, warts and all. That is its beauty, but that is also its shortcoming.
Right.
You know. I mean, I say that because I don't want to give you the cop-out answer. It's like, I love them both. I can't choose. Oh, my God. You know, I'm like,
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
you're the DM for the Black Dice Society, which is a Wizard mm-hmm. Partner show set in Ravenloft that's introducing 5th edition player characters to the setting that was in the recently released Van Richten's Guide. Mm-hmm. How did the opportunity for Black Dice Society come up, and what is the origin of the name?
It's can't see, but this is me showing off my special edition cover of Van Richten's Guide. I was doing a Dark and Wish that stream, and they'd approached me about doing some creator-owned stuff, and I was like, I mean, I would love to, but I'm never going to own a Dark and Wish, even though I created it and I wrote the comic. This is WotC's property. Mm-hmm. And so we talked pretty early about ending that show, bringing the story to a conclusion, and then doing something else. And I'd put a couple of ideas out about what I might want to do. And we're back and forth talking, you know, because it's a long process. And then in December, they reached out to me. And they were like, so we know you know a thing or two about vampires. See the aforementioned 500 sessions.
Yeah.
And we know you know D&D. Would you like to run the Ravenloft game that we want to do? And I was like, yes. Yes, I would.
Right.
And I knew right by the time we got off the phone, I knew the cast I wanted right then. I hit all of them up that day. They all said yes. I did call Mark Mayer first because Ravenloft is his jam.
Yeah.
I literally called Mark. Everybody else got shotgun texts, but they all said yes. And I was very fortunate that I got the cast I wanted and the time slot I wanted. And that is the only time of the entire week that all 7 of us are available at the exact same time. It's literally when we film that show. Mm. No other time are we all available. We started pre-production on it pretty quick. And the reason why I started so early is I was like, I know it seems like we got a long time, y'all, but this is going to go faster than you think. Mm-hmm. And we created characters and commissioned art, like, you know, got our Adam Schubert art for the show and all of those things to be in place at the launch. And I mean, it still ended up just being just down to the wire to be ready in time. But we did it, you know? And now we're 8 episodes in.
Obviously, dealing with horror isn't the same as dealing with fantasy. Not exactly. I mean, Wizards is putting a content warning on BDS because Ravenloft is horror, and you were just awarded the evilest DM. So you must be doing something right. How do you approach storytelling horror specifically in D&D? And to you, what's the most important element of telling a D&D horror story?
Believe it or not, I think the most important element is the consent and safety, mm-hmm. you know, because people have to feel safe to explore things, to let their guard down and show any kind of vulnerability. Because if they can't feel safe, they're going to pull themselves out of it, you know?
Yeah.
I very much had a conversation with everybody of their lines and veils, their go and no go, you know, what is and isn't acceptable for them. I have to be cognizant of that. We have safety tools in place to over the course of the show, if something happens that is like out of hand or making somebody uncomfortable, that we can act on it right then, because even though I know their lines and veils, there's still on occasion going to be things that might like squick somebody out, in the moment.
Yeah.
If we're not careful, which is in, so that's the most important thing. I'd say the second most important thing is, horror is about tension, and tension is about what you don't show. The first Alien movie is, you know, you see the xenomorph for 8 minutes out of the entire movie, mm-hmm. because it's when you just hear something go bump, when you hear claws going down the wall of the cabin you're in, your mind will fill in what it is that is the most frightening thing. And this is true in all forms of description. Like, I love the example I give so often. If I say the most beautiful woman you've ever seen, something came into your mind. Mm-hmm. If I'm like, she's a 5'10 athletic redhead, that may or may not be your jam, you know? And then now, you know, there's a disconnect, you know? Right. So, you know, the describing how things feel, the tone, how things smell, the sounds it makes, the slowly leading up to the reveal, all of that stuff. Because D&D is very much weighted in the favor of the players.
Right.
There is an expectation of victory. That's what CR is all about. That for the most part, if you come across the cave troll, you can take the cave troll, probably. You know, like, I mean, mistakes happen, TPKs happen, but, you know, all things being equal, if an enemy is put in your path, you are up to the challenge of defeating it. That's not true in a lot of games, and that's also not true in Ravenloft. You should not run face first into everything in Ravenloft.
Yeah. And the Van Richten's Guide actually has pays a significant portion of text to making sure that you do have those safety tools, because not everybody has the same fears, and ultimately horror is still about having fun. And if somebody's actually terrified, they're not going to be having fun.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it needs to be, it's cathartic, you know, it's you have to be able to like bring up those emotions and then let them out, you know. Mm-hmm. And you can't stay in an emotional place for too long. No one can. Our nervous system won't let us. Like, mm-hmm. You can't laugh for 2 hours. You can't cry for 2 hours. You can't be on the edge of your seat for 2 hours. That's why movies, they wave the tone up and down. Like, there's lighthearted moments in the darkest of movies. Mm-hmm. There's bummer moments in the funniest of movies, because we need that. It's just how high do you go and how low do you crash, essentially, is the difference.
Right. I think the chemistry amongst the cast on BDS is part of what makes the show compelling. Obviously, each performer is incredibly talented. And like you said, you gave them all messages on that first day. I actually talked to Mark last week. He was recounting the time when you called him in the pharmacy and he couldn't say anything out loud. And what point did you know that they were going to mesh so well? Did you just knew immediately that, I know you knew every performer that you wanted, but did you know that they were going to come together so sort of effortlessly, or was that just fortunate?
I mean, I can say I knew, I can only say I hoped.
Right.
You know, I mean, I knew they were all pros. Mm-hmm. I knew they would all hit the tone I was after and hopefully, you know, mesh well together in the process. But we knew from session zero that we had something. Right. And, you know, and I intentionally got some different kinds of personality types in place for a reason. Mm-hmm. You know, from the bubbly and exuberant to, you know, the fairly mellow straight man type people. Mm-hmm. I won't bust anybody out, but there was one person that was like, because I was like, look, I need you to understand, this is not the dad joke stream. This is not the that's what she said stream. You know, misplaced humor dissipates tension. Tension is essential to horror. So you cannot do that. I need you to understand that. And they were like, I cannot stay serious for 3 hours. Like, it is not in me to do.
Right.
So for them, we came up with a character concept where they were basically going to be the Tasselhod Burfoot. They were going to be the eternal optimist. You know, like, they were going to be the one that is, well, glad that's over. Rah! You know, and that was what we agreed on. And then episode one rolled around and they opened their mouth and that is not who their character was at all. And I was like, OK, we're here now. OK, this is where we are now. So,
well, it's like they say, everybody has a plan until you get punched in the mouth, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, with characters and stuff that I've got that, you know, I do voices and stuff for. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, almost always you find out what they're going to sound like when I find out what they're going to sound like. Yeah. I open my mouth, some comes out. Here we are now. This is how that works. Like, when I did Iris, the beholder for Idle Champions Presents, that Iris is their the corporate motto of CNE Games. She's a mm-hmm. beholder.
Right.
And she was just here, darling. Like, she's just from the Bronx. Then I was like, oh, this is Iris now. I hope they don't hate it. You know, and it turns out they loved it. Because my thought was, she can't sound menacing because everybody already thinks beholders are evil. Mm-hmm. So she's got to sound disarming. You know, what other than like an old granny? You know what I mean? Right. It was fabulous. that apparently smokes a lot. You know, the here we are. This is Iris now.
Nice.
You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So changing topics a little bit. You're the lead developer on Into the Motherlands RPG, which hit Kickstarter last week. Now, I want to talk about that, but I want to talk about Kickstarters in general, because I understand that this is not the first Kickstarter that you've worked on. In fact, you've managed a number of really successful Kickstarters. You don't have to tell me which one specifically.
I'm four for four. I'm three Kickstarters and Indiegogo. Yep.
So, obviously marketing was your background. I'm curious, what are some of the elements that make a successful Kickstarter, and what are some of the traps people should avoid when running one?
I'll start with the traps. You need a following in advance. You know, you say if you build it, they will come. That is not true. Kickstarter is where you go to monetize an existing following, not to build a following. Right. If the fates are kind, it'll kick in, it'll go viral, people tell their friends, you'll have positive word of mouth, and it may expand from there. But understand, you need to have a community in advance that knows you and trusts you for the thing that you're trying to do. I mean, I think I've built up a certain amount of goodwill with people, in the sense that if I was like, I'm trying to produce a jazz fusion album, like a couple of people would be like, you know what, it's probably gonna be dope, but I couldn't raise $100,000 for it, you know?
Right.
You know, so you kind of gotta, you know, fight in your weight class of the things that people know you for, and just start talking in advance about the things you want to be known for. Be wary of getting overly bogged down with physical deliverables. A lot of things that seems like a good idea are a way to lose money and waste time very quickly. And those difficulties become multiplicative. Like shipping two things is not twice as hard, it's three times as hard. Shipping three things is eight times as hard. You know, like you're gonna need a warehouse. Where's all this stuff gonna live? Who's gonna pay for shipping? Like, you know, it can get away from you very quickly. And it's also gonna take a lot of time. You know, and ask yourself, the thing we're delivering, does anybody need it? And to tell you the truth, if no one needs it, that still may be valid if you're like, yeah, but does somebody want it? You know, like no one needs a Ferrari, you know, like at all. No one, you know, but if you can still make the value argument, people still may, you know, bite it. You know, it's a golden age for games and stuff right now, but also a lot of people have been burned by projects that didn't deliver, you know, especially video games that didn't deliver. You know, in just try and put your best foot forward in terms of the presentation. You know, I commissioned, I was thinking commandeered. I'm like, that's not the word. I commissioned all new art for this because I knew we had to put a certain aesthetic out to get people to resonate. If we had not done that, we would not be sitting in nearly $200,000 right now. I'm certain, because people can come to the page and they see it and they're like, I get it. Scroll, scroll, scroll. Dope, 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 dope. Back. That's it. That's what they really are making their decisions based on.
Right.
The words are supplemental, you know, your images and your video are what really sell it.
So is that why it was the show first and then the Kickstarter over time? Because you wanted to develop that following to make it a recognized property that you could then build on to leverage into the Kickstarter for the game?
A bit of both. You know, I don't want to tell too much of Tanya's story. I think she might have told it already. But, you know, the original brainchild came out of her deal with Twitch to produce a certain amount of original content. And the intent as we started creating the game was, we're going to put this out to the world at some point. And, you know, we had the opportunity to talk to a lot of publishers. We're talking to a lot of publishers now, but doing the Kickstarter was in many ways a negotiation tactic.
Got it.
Because there's a world of difference to sit down at the table with someone when you have a Twitch stream and an idea versus $200,000 in the bank and thousands of orders as a proof of concept. You know, and we've already seen the tone of partner discussions change, of people being like, oh, this is serious. Yes, it is. Like, oh, you're serious. Yes, we are.
Yeah.
You know, so that gives us a place of maximum leverage where, because if you can get up and walk away from the table, that's always a good place to be in, you know, So that was why the Twitch stream came first.
Right.
But had the Twitch stream not happened, I think we probably still would have funded just based on the strength of the premise, mm-hmm. but we wouldn't be this far along.
Right.
At this point.
So you answered this question, obviously, but the success of your Kickstarter is going to give you leverage to do a second, a third season of the show and a fourth and fifth and so on, right?
Because Yeah. If the fates are kind, we'll still be in bed with Twitch mm-hmm. for a while. And if for some reason they don't, then now we're in a place where maybe we can do it ourselves, mm-hmm. you know? Who yeah, knows?
For sure.
Who knows?
And it's all predicated on the fact that your Kickstarter has been insanely successful. In five mm-hmm. days, you've raised close to $200,000. When last I looked, it might have hit 200,000. It's certainly more than 200,000 Canadian, but you have 2,500 backers. And it seems from everything sort of that I've read that you've blown through your initial expectations for the goal. So what was your initial expectation and why do you think it has grown so quickly above what you thought?
Well, you know, you always want to make $4 million, you know what I mean? We will be the record breaking most Kickstarterist Kickstarter of all time, you know. But the numbers say 60% of these projects fail, you know. I thought we would end between 200 and 300. Now I think we'll probably end a little north of 400. Probably, mm-hmm. you know, you never know. You know what I mean? Like we might have exhausted the audience and it just bottoms out. I don't think so, but maybe, you know, and that's conservative. There's some estimates that will go higher than that. I don't know. You know, again, I think the minis and the terrain will help. Mm-hmm. But the reality is we knew the minimum we needed to deliver something we could be proud of. And quite frankly, there's a maximum, you know, like there's a certain amount that only so much can be spent on development because past a certain point, you know, we're only going to sell so many copies of the books. Right. You know what I mean? Just no, cause no one does, period. You know? So there's a limit. And then you start to look as well, what can you do beyond that? That's when you start looking at, you know, your ability to do more marketing, to do the next project, you know, just the allowing the business to have its own operating capital and things mm-hmm. of that nature. You know, how well does it position us for the future?
Are you able to share any of the, because you've smashed through all your stretch goals, you've kept adding more. Are you able to give us a hint about what some of the stuff you're thinking about adding next?
With one exception, it is mostly going to be increasing the quality and the content of the book.
Okay.
You know, just making the book bigger and more stuff added to it, and more ancillary benefits. I'm personally trying to avoid a lot more physical deliverables. Mm-hmm. You know, I may be wrong. I might 10 days from now, I might be eating my hat, you know, especially if the numbers are there and the desire's there. Because the challenge is that, yeah, we ask the people, what would you like? But a strange thing happens where lots of people will start telling you what they want, but they're not actually going to purchase, you know? You know, one of my favorite quotes is Henry Ford. If I'd asked them what they wanted, they would have said a faster horse. You know, mm-hmm. so we kind of have to stay true to our own thing here. But enough people said minis and terrain, and I could see enough ways that would help us in the long term.
Right.
That it was worth being like, well, okay, let's do it. You know, there's other things that people are asking for that I just literally read it and I'm like, we're not doing that. Like that's not gonna happen.
Got it.
Yeah.
So the majority of people, myself included, are very excited to see what you and your incredible team develop for this game. Now, in the article that I wrote talking about it, I think your development team is as close to an all-star team as you can get in the tabletop RPG space with Tanya, of course, and Gabe and Jasmine and Eugenio. But there's a small segment of people not necessarily backing the project, but they want to know what the system is going to be or how much of the book is written. Do you think that question is fair given it's not really asked of Kickstarters led by non-POC developers?
Not at all. And here's the reality of the situation. You can tell when someone is asking from a place of excitement and when a person is asking from a place of pretension and diet racism, you know, that again, I'm like, I don't see where anybody asks how much Ouroboros is written. You know, yeah, that's the guy that created Warcraft and Starcraft, and that's great. I backed it sight unseen, but he hasn't made any TTRPG content. So, you know, why aren't you sweating them? You know, the answer is, you know, we could publish what we've written to power the stream tomorrow if we wanted to. As I already said, it is primarily a business tactic to be able to deliver the best possible game that we can. And there's a lot of variables in that that people don't realize when you're on the other side of the table, such as some publishers have retail access, some don't. You know, being able to get your book into Barnes and Noble is, of course, valuable. But some of those people that might have those relationships are like, yes, but we want you to use our system that we have a vested interest in. Okay. Whether or not we'd raised $50,000 would not have given us the headroom to even be able to create our own system if we wanted to. Now we've raised enough capital where that's an option that's available to us should we choose to do it. It's what at the end of the day is going to deliver the best final product. We're not overly precious about those nuts and bolts aspects of it. And my advice to anybody who is apprehensive about that is don't back it. You know, you can back it late or buy it in stores next year. That is okay. You won't hurt our feelings. Yeah.
Considering talking about the design and thinking about what you want to do, the system, how much of what you're planning, like what are the important considerations that are guiding your development? Is it just you're seeing how it goes, talking to other systems, potentially working with them, or are you just basically it's a wait and see now, you're going to make the best decision for the game?
Well, I would divide that question in half because there's the guiding principles of design, which exist independent of the system, which is, you know, we wanted a story with no colonialism, you know, that imperialism and Western exceptionalism and expansionism was not the inciting incident of all of the action. There is no group that believes they are ordained by God to rule over all the other ones. You know, when talking to the contributors, the question I asked all of them is, I'm like, what's the game you wish you could have played when you were 10 years old? Right. What was it that you needed to see? How can we celebrate your culture and heritage in a way that you are proud of? That little kid like you could see here and feel like I'm proud of that, you know, and come from that place. That it is a tale of exploration and discovery in a good future. You know, I mean, bad things are going to happen. I mean, I'm lead developing it. Terrible things are going to happen. But, you know, that's when we talk about Star Trek and Wakanda as touchstones, you know, legally distinct, this book is not those things.
Of course.
It is influenced by those things. You know, we've had to make that distinction. Some people have been like, it's a Star Trek game. It is not. You will get a suit. Stop it. But, you know, Star Trek is about hopeful exploration in a brighter future. They're out there on those Federation starships because they want to be, you know, they're having a good time. Problems come up. They solve those problems and then they keep going, looking around the next corner. That's what I mean. You know, they're not running from something. They're not, you know, woefully antagonized by anything. You know, obviously on occasion, the Borg have their way with things, but for the most part, everyone is out there of their free, the best and brightest are out there of their free will and volition. And that's the, what we wanted to show, you know, that these are advanced, proud, strong, intelligent people, making their way through the cosmos. And that is going to be true, whether it's a D10 system or a D20 system or anything else.
Right. Has anything surprised you about the campaign, the support, or the feedback you received so far?
The speed of it. I knew it would work. I wouldn't have done it if I didn't think it would work.
Yeah.
I didn't think it would work this well, this fast. And it's a very pleasant surprise.
I mean, the first 90 minutes, I mean, that whole day, my feed, it was all people that I'm following backing Motherlands. It was the rapidity of it was incredible, really, because it was just constant. And that was just me. And you have 30,000 followers. You must have seen it even more than I did.
I'd hoped we'd funded in the first day. If we'd made it by the second day, I'd have been a little hesitant, but you know, you kind of can't really exhale until it funds.
Right.
And you know, to have that weight off your chest in 90 minutes was definitely worth the price of admission. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, good luck with the rest of the Kickstarter. I really appreciate you coming on the show. And on a personal note, I wanted to say thank you for jumping in to Quest for the Cure. Because when I first invited you, you know, all I had was an idea and a good cause. But you lent what we were doing a lot of credibility. And, you know, in the last 8 months, we've raised $17,000.
And oh, fantastic.
If it wasn't for that credibility, we wouldn't have gotten started so well. So honestly, thank you for that. I can't thank you enough.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine, man. You know, it's wild to have an opportunity to do something I love and help some people in the process. So whenever the opportunity presents itself, I try to never say no.
Well, I'm grateful to that. Good luck to the rest of the Kickstarter. Hopefully you hit that 400,000 or 500,000. I mean, you'll hit 400,000 Canadian.
Hey, there it is. Hey, one way or another. I didn't specify. I just said 400,000, right?
Exactly. All right, Dave. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, man. You have a good one.
You too.
And that is our show for this week. Thank you for listening. Please subscribe if you haven't and follow us on fortnerd.com. That's at fortnerd, TOTCOM on Twitter. And if you do follow us, please be sure to enter the contest pinned to the account. Or don't. I mean, if you don't want free amazing things, that's completely on you. It's always good having you join me. And remember, if the die is cocked, it doesn't count. I look forward to chatting with you again next week.